are listening to the New City Church podcast. These episodes are recorded live on Gadigal land. Sometimes the audio quality might not be perfect because what you're listening to is a conversation. We don't edit out the chatter. We think that's what makes it authentic. Wherever you're tuning in from, we hope you find this episode encouraging.
Now, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. Indeed, by faith our ancestors received approval. By faith we understand that the world was prepared by the word of God, so that what is seen was made from things which are not visible. By faith, Abel offered to God a more acceptable sacrifice from Cain's. Through this, he received approval as righteous, God himself giving approval to his gifts. He died, but through his faith he still speaks. By faith, Enoch was taken so that he did not experience death, and he was not found because God had taken him. For it was attested before he was taken away that he had pleased God. And without faith, it is impossible to please God, for whoever would approach him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. By faith, Noah, warned by God about events as yet unseen, respected the warning and built an ark to save his household. By this, he condemned the world and became an heir to the righteousness that is in accordance with faith. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to set out for a place that he was to receive as an inheritance. And he set out, not knowing where he was going. By faith, he stayed for a time in the land he had been promised, as in a foreign land, living in tents, as did Isaac and Jacob, who were heirs with him of the same promise. For he looked forward to the city that has its foundations, whose architect and builder is God. By faith, he received power of procreation, even though he was too old and Sarah herself was barren, because he considered him faithful who had promised. Therefore, from him one person, and this one as good as dead, descendants were born, as many as the stars of heaven, and as innumerable grains of sand by the seashore. All of these died in faith, without having received the promises. But from a distance they saw and greeted them. They confessed that they were strangers and foreigners on earth. For people who speak in this way make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. If they had been thinking of the land that they had left behind, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God. Indeed, he has prepared a city for them. By faith, Abraham, when put to the test, offered up Isaac. He who had received the promises was ready to offer up his only son, of whom he had been told, "It is through Isaac that descendants shall be named for you." He considered the fact that God is able even to raise someone from the dead, and figuratively speaking, he did receive him back. By faith, Isaac invoked the blessings for the future on Jacob and Esau. By faith, Jacob, when dying, blessed each of his sons of Joseph, bowing in worship over the top of his staff. By faith, Joseph, at the end of his life, made mention of the exodus of Israelites and gave instructions about his burial. By faith, Moses was hidden by his parents for 3 months after his birth because they saw that the child was beautiful and they were not afraid of the king's edict. By faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called a son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to share ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He considered abuse suffered for the Christ to be greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking ahead to the reward. By faith, he left Egypt, unafraid of the king's anger, for he persevered as though he saw him who was invisible. By faith, he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of blood, so that the destroyer of the firstborn would not touch the firstborn of Israel. By faith, the people passed through the Red Sea as if it were dry land, but when the Egyptians attempted to do so, they were drowned. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell after they had been encircled for 7 days. By faith, Rahab, the prostitute, did not perish with those who were disobedient, because she had received the spies in peace. And what more should I say? For time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, administered justice, obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions, quenched raging fire, escaped the edge of the sword, won strength out of weakness, became mighty in war, and put foreign armies to flight. Women received their dead by resurrection. Others were tortured, refusing to accept release in order to obtain a better resurrection. Others suffered mocking and flogging, and even chains and imprisonment. They were stoned to death, they were sawn in two, they were killed by the sword, they went about in skins of sheep and goats, destitute, persecuted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and mountains, and in caves and holes in the ground. Yet all of these, they were commended for their faith, did not receive what was promised, since God had provided something better, so that they would not, apart from us, be made perfect.
Thank you so much, Chris. I know that's not an easy passage to read out all in one. Congratulations for Chris. Round of applause, please. All right. Hello. How are you all doing? Good? That's good to hear. In case you do not know me, which I think you all do, I'll introduce myself anyway. My name is Sammy. My pronouns are she, her. Super long passage I just asked Chris to read out, and I promise there is a reason why I got Chris to read out the entire thing, just in case you were getting bored. I promise there's a reason behind it. If you do not know me, or if you do not know me super well, I'm Sammy. I usually spend my weeks hanging out in a little retail paradise called JB Hi-Fi. Most of the time I spend there, I'm dealing with a lot of different kinds of people, but that's most of what I do throughout my week. So when Aiden approached me wanting to do the sermon series and doing it for such a beautiful community as yourselves, after having a long lineage of people that have served our community so gratefully, I felt a spiritual calling, or at least like a very physical one that Aiden gave me from their phone, to join in. I wanted to contribute to this space that contributed to me so much, and then it left me to assess for the first time that I've never really assessed this kind of thing before, that if I wanted to give back to the community, what kind of passage I'd want to do. There's a lot of Bible. I don't know if you know that. There's quite a large amount, most of which I feel very inherently unqualified to talk about. So I ended up falling back onto Hebrews 11, which is something that has always loomed large in my mind, and it's always been something in the back of my brain. Good job, Thomas. Always something that's been in the back of my brain that has always struck me, and I've never really known why, but it's always just been something that's been brought up in my head. First time I heard it was probably in church at like 2010, so this would have been back in the Blue Mountains area that I grew up in. Still very conservative church, still kind of baby's first deconstruction, not really knowing what was going on. And I'd only just started making notes during sermons. This is like the first time I'd started doing it. Mainly because it was a good little thing that Christian boys and girls did. But I did it for that reason rather than because I actually wanted to. Realistically, I did it because there was a person I very much appreciated and respected that did write notes inside of their notebooks. I was just like, I should do that. It did, however, lead me to discover that during this talk on Hebrews 11, I was struck by an incredibly impactful verse that I immediately wrote down in my very average handwriting. It was nowhere as good as the handwriting of the person I was trying to imitate and maybe impress. And that verse is the one that we heard earlier from Chris. All of these died in faith without having received the promises, but from a distance they saw and greeted them. And it stuck with me really strongly. It's a sentiment that at the time rang truth of a lot of the teaching of the church I grew up in. It's brutally honest about the trials that are usually faced by the faithful, but it also, at the same time, seems to diminish the pain of their sacrifices under the promise of it all being worth it in the end. And I think in large, that rings true to secular, which is like not religious society as well. I think it's a very tempting idea. Brings to mind things like Boromir saving the hobbits and then getting shot in the chest three times. Things like Van Gogh not living to see his legacy be known throughout the entire world. And as Alexander Hamilton puts it, legacy being planting seeds in a garden you never get to see. It's this pull towards this concept that I think you could very easily describe as martyrdom, is the concept that's kind of being discussed here. So at the cost of biting off more than I can chew, I want to talk about it. Martyrdom. Why? Why it's so important? And at the cost of maybe doing it wrong, let's go in together. The book of Hebrews itself was written by unknown. Don't really know who it was. For a time, people thought it was Paul. Since then, everyone's agreed it's definitely not Paul. But written to a group of believers in Rome around the time of Emperor Nero. It's not certain who wrote it, just that they were a person that was well-educated. The writing in the book is very linguistically dense. They use a lot of linguistic techniques that kind of borrow from Greek and Roman traditions and things like that. So we only know that they knew the Torah really well, and they were really well-read. It's also assumed that the readers that he's writing to have just as much knowledge of the Torah as this person does. They use he, him pronouns in the earlier scripts for it, so we're pretty sure it's a male. The believers in Rome, these believers that knew the Torah really well, that were steeped in Jewish traditions, were already facing a lot of persecution in Rome. The Roman population did not have a super high expectation of them because they didn't worship the same gods as the Romans. They didn't go into the same religious festivals that the Romans did. They abstained from doing those for obvious reasons. They met in private, these Christians, whereas the Romans preferred to meet in public, in a public forum, so it was seen as dishonest. So not only were they not already thought highly of by the Roman people, they unfortunately also are the target of even more persecution when a little thing called the Great Fire of Rome happens. Destroys about three quarters of the city, and Nero, sensing a little crack in the armor of the Christians, just places the blame on them. In reality, it was probably him that started it. Due to this, he persecuted them. And this is around the time that the Book of Hebrews was probably written. Nero tied them to stakes. He paraded them around in public. He disguised them in animal skins, threw them to wild dogs, and for some reason crucified and set on fire to serve as lanterns in Nero's feasts. Horrible treatment. Just the absolute worst that you could ever think of doing to a people. And even the greater population of Rome, separate from Nero, after this had been going on a while, understood that same aspect, that this wasn't righteous justice. This was one man with hateful retribution punishing a people that didn't deserve it. Pointless violence that doesn't really mean anything. And I'd be remiss not to mention Minneapolis. So our poor author, poor guy, has the simple task of writing to these people, encouraging them, teaching them, making sense of a situation that is inherently senseless. Can I offer you a sermon in this trying time? And he does it by slam poetry. I don't think the entire book is, just chapter 11, hence why I got Chris to read out the entire thing. I think it's really important that when you're reading through it, you feel how the chapter flows, the kind of repetitions that he's using, and you fall into the rhythm of it a little bit, which is really important to understanding what I think it's trying to say. Separate of chapter 11, the first 10 chapters of the book are very strict teaching. It's almost a vicious attack on the practices of the Levitical priests, Levitical meaning of the tribe of Levi, that was the tribe of priests that did most of the Old Testament priestly duties. And it's calling the practices of those priests or the law or the Old Covenant into question by emphasizing Jesus's unique nature as the, Jesus's unique nature in the sense that he was a singular sacrifice versus the Old Covenant's continuous sacrifices. The Old Covenant, every affront that you made to God had to be made up with an individual sacrifice, burnt offerings, flesh offerings, blood offerings, things like that. Jesus in the book
he explains in these first chapters is different in many different ways. He's of a different tribe, so he's not from the tribe of the Levites. He's from the Melchizedek tribe. His unique descent into morality is also called out, that God or her angels do not ever do. Only Jesus does mortality. And his example is a one-time sacrifice. So these chapters read as like dense discussions and dissections of what the sacrifice in the life of Jesus means for this faith, that he's so steeped in the Torah and Old Testament that they probably didn't know a lot about this. He even draws attention to it by pointing out that these are the basic elements of the oracles of God. You need milk, not solid food. So I feel like what we're kind of reading in the first 10 chapters is like baby's first gospel. It's like, for these believers out of Rome, they experienced faith one way for so long, and now the author is showing them that there is a new way to do it that is so much more freeing. A fundamental rebuild of how they view sin and repentance, and it's written in service to this penultimate idea of an unshakable hope. This is as you get into chapter 10. It's the certainty that the new covenant of Jesus lets us approach God freely, without panicking about old rituals, the old covenant, which sacrifice was given where, to who, to how, to why. And then I think the author gets to chapter 10 and realizes that a bolstering of faith through teaching, while it is super important and relevant, might not be enough in this situation for these faithful people. I think he's gotten the theological teaching down to a T. After reading this letter, those believers in Rome are going to go out with a really good and solid foundation for what the sacrifice on the cross that Jesus did means for these people. I think they still need encouragement to be able to do that, to keep going. And this is where I think the poetry of chapter 11 kicks in. The flow and literary devices of the passage switch up to an almost trance-like rhythm as verse 4 hits. And you feel it in the reading, right? By faith, Abel offered to God. By faith, Enoch was taken. By faith, Noah warned by God. By faith, Abraham. By faith, he stayed for a time. He's still teaching, still giving examples of great biblical heroes that we should aspire to. Heroes that are first and foremost in this passage called upon to display their unrivaled trust and commitment to God and give the reader something to aspire to. In the first section of the book, first section of the chapter, specifically Abel, Enoch, Noah, Abraham. But it's not just teaching. It moves and breathes like a piece of poetry does, intentionally written to make the reader not just engage intellectually, but emotionally to what is being said. The repeated use of the phrase, by faith, cuts through the words that are being read, that the audience is reading. It cuts through the horrid persecution they're going through, until you can emotionally resonate with the idea of faith itself as a concept and draw comfort from it. And verse 4 to 12 just is only getting started. In between verse 12 and verse 16, there's that break that contains the passage that I love so much, the short break that captured my heart. The author recognizes that all of these died in faith without having received the promises. I'm going to get back to that, but for the sake of flow and timeliness, I'm going to do it in a bit. The poem continues after verse 16, after this short break. It uses the same rhythm that is established in the first half, now just talking about Abraham's direct line and Moses. By faith, Abraham, when put to the test. By faith, Isaac invoked blessings. By faith, Jacob, when dying. By faith, Joseph, at the end of his life. By faith, Moses was hidden. By faith, he left Egypt. Despite it being the same tempo as you use in 4 to 12, you now have a precedent. You're starting to feel and see the weight and the recognition that the author is trying to do something very intentional that goes beyond just mentioning a bunch of historic figures. I think this is where you start seeing faithfulness at the emotional level that the author is going for, as a driving force that is more than just the actions these people are doing, but faith as a generation-spanning tradition that has more power than just the words describing it can give to it. Because why do you use poetry and rhythmic composition to describe faith? It's to go under an idea. It's when explaining it isn't just enough. To spend time meditating under the surface of the idea of faith instead of just skimming along the top of it. So you get into it now. You're following along with the rhythm that the author is setting, which makes the sudden transition in verse 29 more impactful, this is when you really start to see them use the verse or the term in faith a lot more consistently. It increases the tempo that we've already gotten used to. The author's now using this by faith every verse instead of just every 3 to 4 verses. The examples of the faithful he's giving you come at you hard and fast with much more passion and an outcry and a declaration of, what more should I say? For would time fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David and Samuel and the prophets? You'd be forgiven to think of this as an indictment against the current faithfulness of the audience here. But that rings tone deaf to me. Not for these people. Not after what they've been through. This reads to me as the author reaching out in his own faithfulness, saying, come with me. See what great work you can be a part of. In this climax of rhythm and repetition, it gives as many examples of faithfulness as there are people to be faithful. No one way of God showing to be more important than other ways of showing faith to God, as long as you are faithful. The last 10 verses in rapid succession cover pacifism, from shutting the mouths of the lions like Daniel does, to bringing down the walls of Jericho, to being made strong out of weakness like Ruth was, to withstanding mocking and harsh treatment, to even, unfortunately, suffering death. Can a reader take one action to do out of this? Or do they take a feeling with them? Poems are emotional by nature. They speak to everyone differently, in the same way that the Bible speaks to everyone differently. So what does it say to you? What does this tempo and poem language say to you? What emotions does it draw out? Is the action of the heroes important? Is the generation-spanning timeline of God's work what strikes you the most? What do you think a people hunted down and executed by Nero find comfort in? I would be misleading you not to mention the common interpretation that I heard growing up, and many of you also may have heard when you were growing up as well, if you've grown up in churches. If not, first time, hello. The understanding that's often taught to me, and I think a lot of other people in churches, is an understanding that stems from this idea of faith at all costs, no matter what. Because earlier in the book, in chapter 6 that we haven't read, the author is very adamant that should anyone fall away from this new covenant in Jesus, if Jesus has done all of this work and this footwork and come and died on the cross, that if you turn away from that new covenant, you'll be unable to come back to any degree. It's a passage that's been talked over for as long as there's been theological discussion, and it's not my purpose to revisit that, nor make a decision for you on what you think it means. But that chapter early in the book sometimes brings with it a fear that I think bleeds into chapter 11 sometimes. Fear that if you don't give up every part of your existence down to your very life, like a lot of examples in chapter 11 do, you will be forsaken. So a common thread that's sometimes identified when you hear this passage taught is that of martyrdom, which is an interpretation that I used to hold to very strongly. I think the reason why it's such a popular interpretation, and not only just in this interpretation, but why it's so popular in culture, it's such a well-defined trope, like the ones I mentioned earlier are only the skimming of the barrel of how many stories use it. I think it's popular because in a way it's easy, and in another way, it's one of the hardest things anyone will ever do. It's one decision that someone makes in a split second that will solidify your faithfulness for eternity, set you in the annals of history for eternity. Now, those people in chapter 11 and the people throughout history that have given their lives for their faith, they are heroes for our faith. They should be remembered, commemorated for what they did, just like Marsha P. Johnson should be remembered or Harvey Milk should be remembered, or any number of social justice reformers that have paid a heavy cost. They are important. They do such amazing work. But the author and the readers and us sitting here today know that the persecution in Rome was abhorrent. The secular Roman citizens knew it was abhorrent as well. They knew that it was wrong for them to be punished the way they were. So I struggle with taking the idea of martyrdom as a message from this chapter, considering what the readers were going through. I struggle with fear being a motivating factor behind faithfully following God, and I truly believe that if you see persecution as a sign of your faithfulness, you're going to start seeing it everywhere. I said I'd come back to verse 13 to 16 earlier, and I'm a woman of my word. So here it is. All of these died in faith without having received the promises, but from a distance. They saw and greeted them. They confessed that they were strangers and foreigners on the earth, for people speaking this way make it clear that they are seeking a homeland. If they had been thinking of the land that they had left behind, they would have had the opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better homeland, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God. Indeed, he has prepared a city for them. If the way that chapter 11 is written is intended as a poem of encouragement that emphasizes not just the actions of these people, or not even the actions at all, but the underlying emotion and the idea of faith as this generation-spanning, powerful concept, what do the readers in Rome take away from it? From a distance, they saw and greeted the promises. The readers aren't in the promise yet because it's not been made perfect. But they can take their much-needed comfort during this persecution from the community of faith that's come before them. The homeland is already in the process of being built, even though it's not complete yet. So they draw their strength from the knowledge that they're a part of the construction. There is existing work and community being done for them that they can draw on, while knowing that they're providing the same to generations that come after. A work of wholeness that's bigger than their life, brought to the forefront through poetry. Where do you see your homeland being built? I see it here, with these people, with my family. Still imperfect from the different kinds of persecution that these Roman believers faced. Different, still important, still makes it imperfect. But make no mistake, from this persecution isn't the goal. Confidence that we have and are still building towards something better is the goal.